We're perusing the Milwaukee Anthology on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's a new collection of nonfiction essays and poems that together create this patchwork of life and times in Milwaukee. And the writing is sourced from people who come from all walks of life in their city. Milwaukee Anthology joins a group of more than a dozen cities in a series by the Cleveland-based indie press called Belt Publishing. What do you think is the best or most interesting thing about your city? What stories don't get enough attention about Milwaukee? Join in at 800-642-1234. Justin Kern is editor of the Milwaukee Anthology, which comes out today. Justin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate, and for sharing more about the book with your audience.
So Milwaukee is your oyster here. When you were considering pieces for the anthology, what were you looking for?
I think part of the purpose of what Belt is looking for with these city anthologies is kind of these lesser heard, maybe necessary stories about the Midwest. There's a lot of head scratching about the Midwest from people outside of the Midwest after some recent elections and other things. So I think they were looking to kind of change the paradigm. And for me, that kind of meant taking our city beyond, you know, motorcycles, cheese curds, the bronze fawns. You know, all those things are great. They have like a place, of course, in our city. But sharing the actual kind of diversity, the challenges, the kind of more day-to-day triumphs of Milwaukee.
I heard those echoes of challenges and in the diversity. I mean, when you sought people out and really put the call out for writing, you really wanted to hear from different groups, different people from different perspectives.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of that, the kind of the Roxane Gay quote about like that the Midwest is, you know, obviously a very diverse place. It's just a place that certainly in Milwaukee's instance has a lot of challenges when it comes to segregation or having those diverse voices heard, right? Like everybody in Milwaukee isn't an unemployed white drywaller, you know? I mean, like, that exists here. I drank with some of those guys at the Newport down in Milwaukee sometimes, but it's a diverse, rich place with many voices. And that was kind of one of the driving points behind getting a lot of voices, opening up to as many voices as possible for this book.
Well, let's get into the pieces. Let's look at this piece about Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood, which is known most recently for the riots that happened in the summer of 2016. And that was after Sylville Smith was shot and killed by a policeman. The essay is about a community mural in Sherman Park and how it's impacted the residents there. Can you tell us about this mural?
Sure, yeah. It's a really fantastic piece that Tia pulled together.
Tia Richardson.
Tia Richardson, mm-hmm. Right, the author and kind of community organizer around this mural. And she explains it really well in the piece as this kind of, she thought it was going to be this rallying cry to paint something for the neighborhood. Then the you know, kind of unrest happened. The incident, obviously the fatal incident with Sylville happened. And then it became this entirely different, almost conversation piece where people were kind of challenging what it means to live in that neighborhood and looking for something that was, and I hope, you know, this is something I think you might see a little thread of throughout the book that although there are some challenges, there is a lot to love, and there are some amazing neighbors and initiatives going on all around us. So I think Tia pulls that together, and I'd encourage everyone to go check out the mural. It'd be a great opportunity if you haven't been to Sherman Park to see it much more beyond the headlines from a few years ago.
And it seems that Tia is trying to get out that Sherman Park is this beautiful community that people pull together in this community, and that is what is really speaking to this mural and what it's trying to convey.
Right, and there's even Laura Richard Marshall earlier in the book has an essay about kind of being a homeowner and some of what that's fraught with in Sherman Park at times. And I think, there are a number of neighborhoods where in our city where I guess one of the challenges in Milwaukee in my thinking and what I've seen and what I read in the book certainly is that the city makes it too easy for us to be divided and broken up. Essays like Tia's and others in the book kind of challenge that and push people to not only get to know their own neighbors next door, but, you know, a few neighborhoods over even.
We're talking with Justin Kern, editor of the Milwaukee Anthology. Dozens of writers contributed pieces of poetry and prose about their city. It's all in this new anthology, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you know any books, essays, or poems about Milwaukee that you'd like to share? Do you write about your own city or town? What inspires your works? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Justin, Pardeep Kalipa writes an essay for the anthology about the 2012 Sikh temple shooting. Six people were killed, including Pardeep's father, who was the president of the temple. What does this essay tell us about that day, about that time?
Oh, that was, even in the request, which, I mean, Pardeep did an absolutely amazing and, like, humbling job in recounting that day and kind of moving forward with the temple, but that was, from the editor's perspective and even from the pitch to him, was hard to work through because it's tragic. I mean, it's hard. It's impossible to process. And I think that's some of what he conveys in the story. But that was an important one to put out there, I thought, because of, you know, I think that that instance was maybe easy if you didn't know people from the Sikh community, if you had no friends there, it might have been easier for people on the outside to really box up that incident as an isolated thing. And I think what Pardeep gets at there is that there are deeper community values and opportunities that he has kind of taken from that tragedy, as hard as it is. And he does a really amazing job kind of recounting the day ahead, the day before the last time he saw his father, as well as the incident, and then kind of moving how the temple has kind of tried to move forward.
Well, in the last day he saw his father, he's recounting this family gathering, and the men are gathered around. They're having some drinks. They're talking about being small business owners. Yep. And there's a real sense of strength in a family, of communities, of support. And then you find that there's this unraveling as the shooting happens at the temple, and Pardeep is so confused as to how to even get to the temple because the police have, you know, coordinated all off.
Yeah, a thing no one could ever plan for or know. I mean, and you're so that's set up where he's kind of like. I think everyone in Wisconsin, regardless of your background, what Pardeep kind of shows in the beginning of that is like most everyone, I think, in Wisconsin, regardless of your background, has had that experience where you're at a family. It's Pardeep's birthday party in the case of this book, and people are split up where there's folks downstairs drinking a couple of whiskeys and talk about business and whatnot, and then some other people are cooking and the kids are running around. I mean, it's this very typical family gathering experience that really defies the, you know, whatever labels, whatever religion or creed that you'd want to put on people. And in that same sense, then, you know, just days later, they're faced with the absolutely unimaginable circumstance of a mass shooting.
We're exploring the Milwaukee Anthology with its editor, Justin Kern, and you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Milwaukeeans, what do you think is the best or most interesting thing about your city? What stories don't get enough play, enough attention about Milwaukee? Do you write poetry or essays about your own city or town or community? What are they like? Can you share them with us? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back in a minute right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the new Milwaukee Anthology, part of the City Series from Belt Publishing. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 50 writers submitted their nonfiction works, essays, prose, poetry. It's all inspired by life in Milwaukee. And you can join in with ideas for place-based writing at 800-642-1234. Do you know any books, essays, or poems about Milwaukee that you'd like to share? You can call in, email ideas@wpr.org. Justin Kern is editor of the Milwaukee Anthology that's out today, and he stays with us. Justin, I want to go back in time now and talk about this fascinating piece of labor history, the 1886 Bayview Massacre. And it's been noted as Wisconsin's bloodiest labor incident. Can you tell us first about what happened on May 5th, 1886, and the events that led up to it?
Ken is the historian, and he writes the piece in the book. So he, you know, he gives the detailed account. But as I live up the street from this monument, so have the chance to walk by it a few times and see the event, actually. But the rolling mill that was down there, the main employer in the city, as happened a lot in the late 1800s, there was kind of a riot between the private guards of the industry and then the organizing forces of labor, and was a fatal afternoon. And now every May, the a bunch of labor organizations get together and kind of commemorate this this incident that happened that was among the most bloody in labor history in the United States.
Well, Ken Germanson writes about this being about the 8-hour workday and trying to set rights for workers. How has that informed this gathering each year on that massacre day?
Yeah, he had this really great kind of conflicted view of it, right? Like recent Wisconsin labor history, there obviously been some, you know, the protests and stuff around collective bargaining in Madison, and the kind of decline in union membership, but at the same time that this event is this rallying force for all types of organized labor. So and it's this very visual, cool event too. There are these giant puppets and these kind of like wispy folk songs that actually the Ghosts of Bayview, where the title comes from, is from kind of an old labor rallying song. So it's this cool kind of galvanizing moment that I think a lot of people might not stop and know is even kind of happening every year in spring, just a few weeks from now.
Yeah, and it's like you can see, and he writes about this, that solidarity is still alive, that for some reason, people, hundreds of people still turn out.
Yeah, and I think, and he mentions kind of the strength of unions at one point in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin, and certainly there is still some strength there, but he gets to tap on those aspects of Milwaukee's socialist history and what that kind of meant. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to make sure with this book was that it wasn't this kind of political one side versus the other bashing kind of thing. But Ken does an amazing job in this sense of tying in some history with some with aspects of the present day and what's really relevant on people's minds when it comes to labor and when it comes to Milwaukee.
And an event emceed by Anita Zeidler, which she is a retiree of UW-Milwaukee, but her late father, Frank, was the socialist mayor of Milwaukee from 1948 to 1960.
Yeah, last name that would be familiar to anyone looking around some of the parks and some of the history books in our city.
Well, let's move on to April being National Poetry Month. Can you tell us about Everything Bruce Lee at 7 Mile Fair in Orange by Robert Earl Thomas?
Yeah, Robert, lucky enough to call Robert a friend too, and he's just a great poet and great musician in our city. And it was one of the pieces that I had reached out to someone and asked about. I knew that Robert had this kind of experience growing up with his family being vendors at 7 Mile Fair. And if I could, just as an aside, like, to me, 7 Mile Fair is the best of everything about Milwaukee and Wisconsin. I know it may seem like tacky or cheesy or that kind of thing, but it is without question the one place every type of person from Milwaukee and Wisconsin hangs out, which I think is super important. And they also have like great corn and a bar, and like you can see like cool music of the Andes and buy like some knockoff shoes. It's like a perfect it's a perfect place, and everybody goes there. So anyway, so Robert does this amazing job of kind of tying in, and it might sound a little silly, but it really is ridiculously amazing. He does this great job of tying in kind of like his own coming to being as a man from his youth to kind of the present day through the lens of this flea market. And it's just this like provocative and really funny and detailed piece that highlights, you know, just kind of how brilliant of a poet he is, of course, but just all of the really vivid, fun, human elements of 7 Mile Fair.
Could you read a little bit for us? Give us a taste?
Sure. With apologies to Robert, this, you know, an excerpt that y'all had requested. So here's just a short snippet from Robert's poem on 7 Mile Fair in the Milwaukee Anthology. Parrots, chickens, puppies, carne asada, necklaces, speakers, solvents, tires, fields of socks, fruits, vegetables, massages, Quranic visions, Quranic advisors, reading glasses as anti-fogging agent wipes. If it were winter for a while in Milwaukee, a Conomilwaukee Shaw, let tomorrow be the day that we get away with murder, or at the very least, try to sell overpriced Lenny Dykstra and Greg Jeffries baseball cards.
If that isn't a mashup of so many different things, that is beautiful. Thank you for that.
Thank Robert. Yeah, it's that is one of the views. I mean, when I was said earlier, kind of the lesser heard, the necessary stories. Obviously, there are some urgent and challenging aspects of our city, but there are also so many aspects of joy and wonder, I think, that we can still find all around us. And if you find it at a flea market, more power to you.
Justin Kern, you're not actually from Milwaukee originally.
Exposed, yes.
Why are you so drawn to the city?
I outside of a few unfortunate years in my early life in Dallas, I mostly grew up in Western New York.
Dallas, no less.
I know. The opposite of like everything. And we can get into why Dallas is Dallas. But So I grew up in Western New York in a small kind of hardscrabble town called Dunkirk, named for the one in France, but with far fewer miracles. Very much like Wisconsin Rapids for kind of local reference. And then I went to college and spent a bunch of years in Buffalo, which is also in its own right an amazing Great Lakes city. But came out here as a journalist in 2005. Milwaukee really won me over. It has a lot of aspects that I love about Buffalo. But it has its own character, its own challenges, its own like kind of chip on its shoulder. And there was something about while, you know, yes, maybe an outsider, interloper to some, I think I being from outside has afforded me a little bit of a viewpoint of seeing the city differently and maybe not having kind of neighborhood, my feet cemented in a neighborhood or that kind of thing. It would kind of force when you're from outside somewhere, especially moving to a city where, frankly, not a lot of people outside of Wisconsin move to, you are kind of forced to find out a place on your own.
You have fresh eyes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You know, I think as opposed to somewhere like Chicago, where everyone's actually from Iowa and tries to say they're just from Chicago or Chicagoland, like Milwaukee, if you come to Milwaukee, like they make you earn your time here. And because of that, I feel it's been much more valuable. And you know, in the meantime, I've been able to meet my wonderful wife, who's from outside of here, and, you know, live in Bayview, where we've raised three beautiful young cats. And
let's have you read the book's epigraph and as an ending here. Can you read the quote, the one that starts out the book?
Sure. The truth begins with us. Instead of passing each other like ships in the night, we must fight until our truths stretch to the ends of the world. And that's by Sandra Parks.
And Sandra Parks, who, for those who aren't familiar, she's this young girl in Milwaukee who wrote an essay about gun violence and was killed in her home in Milwaukee by a stray bullet.
This happened as I was kind of finishing the manuscript, actually, and it really spoke to me. I mean, it's really tragic, obviously. There's no way to get around that part of it, but I think what's important to take away, as well as her memory, is that this doesn't define who this young person was. This young person was an amazing writer. And there are too many young people in the city that maybe get defined by these violent acts or by by something terrible when really we should be propping young people up as much as possible, because they're going to be leading the city not too long from now.
And the truth begins with us. Why did you find that so fitting as you chose that quote for this anthology?
Yeah, you know, this book, there was no thematic goal with the book. You know, I wanted it to be kind of a patchwork thing. I wanted it to seem almost a little eclectic. But there's something in what Sandra wrote that I think does touch on what it means to live here, and a thing that we should all consider when it comes to Milwaukee, which is to get to know each other, to not be stuck in our neighborhoods, to not be stuck in our homes, to not be afraid of each other, but to explore and to find out more about each other and love each other.
Justin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Justin Kern is editor of the Milwaukee Anthology, which comes out today. Coming up, farmers across the state and nation are gathering to discuss solutions to the financial strains on the dairy industry. We'll discuss those strategies after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about a plan to stabilize the dairy industry on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over the past decade, the Agriculture Department recorded the loss of about 17,000 dairy herds. That cuts the total number of herds in our country by a third. Wisconsin lost 691 dairy farms last year alone, and that's according to data from the National Agricultural Statistics Service. Now farmers across the state and nation are gathering at these events to talk about policy and economic initiatives that could help rebuild this industry. Dairy farmers, how are you doing? Tell us your story. What has changed over the years? What challenges are you up against? Have you made adjustments to manage low milk prices? We're at 800-642-1234. Bobby Wilson is Government Relations Associate for the Wisconsin Farmers Union, which is organizing the Dairy Together Roadshow. Bobby, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this Dairy Together initiative, and more specifically, these roadshow events that are happening across the state and nation.
Sure. So starting with a little background on Dairy Together, we started this grassroots movement about a year ago in 2018. It started with a series of meetings that we held around the state where we invited Canadian dairy farmers to come talk to our members about their supply management or quota system. And we thought this would be an educational opportunity to learn about how Canada does things differently, and to maybe break through some of the blame that was directed towards Canada at the time for the low milk prices that we're seeing here in the U.S. But what we didn't expect was for this to spark such a huge grassroots movement, and to really spark the imaginations of our dairy farmers here, who for some of them imagined for the first time having a system that works better than what we have now. So following these meetings, we were just kind of blown away by the number of people who started contacting us saying, I really think this idea has merit. I think we should push for something like that here, and I want to get involved. How can I get involved? So we started organizing these farmers, getting them together throughout the last year to try to push for changes in federal dairy policy to stabilize our prices. So this Dairy Together Roadshow that we're currently organizing is part of this ongoing Dairy Together campaign, and this is about taking a closer look at solutions for stabilizing the dairy industry.
Yeah, and so the Wisconsin Farmers Union and the National Farmers Organization are going to communities presenting plans to help dairy farmers. And before we get into the proposals, how have farmers and community members been responding all over the country?
So far the response has been very positive. I think there's an acknowledgement that what we have now is not working. It's not acceptable that we're losing hundreds, thousands of dairy farmers every year, and we need to look at stopping this downward trend in the number of farms that we have. And so I think there's consensus that we need to do something, and now it's about what's the right path forward, what's going to get us out of this situation and to bring real prosperity back to our dairy economy and back to rural communities.
And small dairies in particular are hurting. You know, Wisconsin lost a record number last year, 691 small dairies. For short-term relief, this effort is proposing that the Family Dairy Farm Relief Act. Can you tell us about this legislation, what it would do?
Sure. So that one is proposed by National Farmers Organization, so I can speak to it just in general terms, but NFO has more details about their proposal. So they're proposing an emergency relief payment. It would be a direct payment based on average cost of production across six tiers of farm sizes. So just an immediate payment to help farms hang on a little bit longer, get through the next couple of seasons until we can get a fair price from the marketplace.
But farmers have been stuck in this cycle of subsidies and insurance for years now. Would a bill like this just perpetuate the problem?
That's the concern, is that what we're hearing from farmers is that they don't want another handout. They don't want another government subsidy. Everyone just wants to earn a fair price. And so the Emergency Dairy Relief Act is just to stop the bleeding, but it needs to be coupled with a longer-term solution, because we can't just keep throwing money at a problem without actually fixing it.
Well, let's take a look at the Dairy Price Stabilization Plan. I mean, the program is intended to slow the loss of small farms and act as this bridge to a longer-term solution of this problem with overproduction. So how do we get there?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So implementing something like the Dairy Price Stabilization Plan would require an act of Congress. So we know that farmers support this idea. We're hearing a lot of engagement from the National Holstein Association and other groups that want to take a closer look at this plan. And this wouldn't just be a bridge. This is something that could be a sustainable long-term solution to manage the overproduction in the dairy industry. So we think this idea has a lot of merit, and we hope that we can take this up with our elected officials and members of Congress and get some traction on this plan.
So how would it look on a national level? How would it work out?
Yeah, so the Dairy Price Stabilization Plan is not a new idea. It was introduced back in 2010, and it actually passed the House. So it was not implemented into law, but this is not a new idea. This is something that we've thought about before. And the way that it works is that each year, the USDA would set an allowable rate of milk production growth, and farms who stay within that allowable growth rate can just continue producing as normal. Anyone that decides to expand beyond that growth rate would have to pay a market access fee in order to expand. So essentially what they're doing is paying for an additional share of the market, and those market access fees would be pooled and distributed among all the farms that stay within that allowable rate of production growth. So what you have is a balancing out. You're essentially paying other farmers for an additional share of the market if you want to expand and potentially have a negative impact on the overall milk price.
We're talking with Bobbi Wilson. She is Government Relations Associate for the Wisconsin Farmers Union. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Farmers, have you been hurt by low milk prices? Would you support supply management? Why or why not? And if not, what policy changes would you like to see to make dairy more successful? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. When you look at the Dairy Price Stabilization Plan, what have economists and researchers who have evaluated the strategy, what have they said?
So we asked two researchers to take a look at this plan, Chuck Nicholson from Cornell University and Mark Stevenson from UW-Madison, and they updated the Dairy Price Stabilization Plan under current market conditions, and we were actually very pleased with the results. Their results show a doubling of net farm operating income, a slowing of these dairy farm exits. So we can say with certainty that we would save hundreds of farms if we had this plan in place. We saw an increase in the overall milk price, and one thing that's really appealing about this plan is that it doesn't cost the government anything. And in fact, it reduces the subsidies that we're already paying through the dairy margin coverage program.
Does it say anything about what the end consumer would be paying at the grocery store?
So they assume that this would have a small impact on retail milk prices, and that that could result in slightly lower consumption of dairy products, which we understand is a concern for some people. But what we found is that you could increase the cost or the price that we're paying to farmers substantially and just have a tiny impact on the retail price for dairy products. And when we talk to consumers about this, they say we'd be willing to pay an extra 50 cents to know that we're supporting small farmers.
So how does that parlay into this structured dairy pricing program to curb overproduction? How does that work?
So the tiered structural management proposal is different. It actually would not directly curb overproduction.
Okay.
This is looking at the way that milk is priced and reallocating the money that is distributed through the federal order pool to pay farmers based on their cost of production.
And when you say federal order pool, what do you mean by that?
So we have a system in the United States called the Federal Milk Marketing Orders, and that's how all milk is priced based on its end product use. So it would be overlapping with that system that we already have and changing the way that those funds are allocated to, instead of just recognizing the use of the dairy products, it's also recognizing the cost that it takes farmers pay to produce milk.
How are farmers feeling about supply management? Because this can really impact their business and their bottom line.
Yeah, so most farmers that we're talking to are open to this idea, and we have seen that this dialogue is really shifting. A couple of years ago, when we said supply management, most people immediately thought of the Canadian quota system, and there was a little bit of pushback against that. So when we talk about supply management, we're not just talking about quota. There are a number of options and ways of stabilizing the dairy market that's not a quota necessarily, but that is more like this market access fee program that would do a lot to raise the overall price for farmers. And I think that's very appealing across the board.
Wisconsin Farmers Union President Darren Von Ruden said, "We can't export our way out of this problem." What role do global markets have in the fate of Wisconsin's farmers?
So we do understand that as it currently stands, exports make up a significant amount of farm income, about 20%. But we've been increasing exports for the last 25 years, and this is the state of the dairy economy. We can't keep endlessly chasing these export markets, because as soon as we find a new market, immediately we'll ramp up production to take advantage of that new market demand. Mm-hmm. And so We're producing faster than we can find markets, and this strategy is simply not working. We can't export our way out of this. And when we look at exports accounting for 20% of farm income, that doesn't mean a whole lot when farm income is a negative number.
We're talking with Bobbi Wilson. She is the Government Relations Associate for the Wisconsin Farmers Union. Her organization is behind the Dairy Together Roadshow that recently made stops in Eau Claire, Oshkosh, and Platteville. There's a meeting today in Michigan, more stops coming in Minnesota, Vermont, New York, New Mexico, and California. Rural Wisconsinites, how has your area been impacted by small dairy farms? What impact has it had on your community? And farmers, would you support supply management? Why or why not? You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your ideas about how to make dairy more resilient. We'll be back in a minute right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about depressed milk prices and events happening around the country to help generate policy ideas to rebuild the dairy industry. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last year, Wisconsin led the nation in farm bankruptcies for the third straight year, and dairy farms closed at the highest pace this century. We're hearing reports that some dairy farmers are selling their dairy cows and investing in other livestock such as beef cattle and goats. Farmers straight across the country are meeting to discuss the economic conditions and how to come up with policy ideas. Have you been hurt by low milk prices? Have you seen your neighbors and small farmers in your community get out of the dairy business? Does that worry you? Rural Wisconsinites, has your area lost small-scale dairy farms? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Bobbi Wilson stays with us. She is Government Relations Associate for the Wisconsin Farmers Union. And let's go straight to the phones now with Maureen joining us from Mineral Point. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, I'm no expert in dairy farms by a long shot, but there are two factors that seem kind of like they've probably influenced this. And one is using bovine growth hormone, BGH, to increase production. That's been around for a bit. And the other are these large operations, I believe they're called CAFOs. And it just seems like those two factors are probably contributing quite a bit to this, are they?
Maureen, great question. Let's start with CAFOs, the centralized animal feeding operations.
Sure. So what we have now is a federal policy that incentivizes producing as much as possible, as cheaply as possible. So CAFOs definitely fit that description. And what we're seeing when these small dairy farms go out of business, the cow numbers have stayed relatively stable. So the cows are being sold onto these very large farms, and we're not actually reducing the overall milk supply. So that's really contributing to this problem. And also what we're seeing is that while farms have been lost in all size categories, up to about 1,000 farms, we've seen a doubling of farms between 1,000 and 2,000 cows, over tripling of farms, 2,000 cows or more. So this is part of the problem, that they're producing more milk and they're producing it less expensively than the smaller farmers. So that is continuing with this glut of milk.
So would the stabilization plan, though, impact these CAFOs?
It would. So with the market access fee, there is a range in market access fees that farms would have to pay if they want to expand. Those fees are higher for larger farms than they are for small farms, because we recognize that these large farms could have a much larger impact on the price when they expand versus a small farmer with 50 to 100 cows, for example. So that is how that's the most direct way that these large farms would be affected by it and having to pay a higher market access fee.
Let's go to Aaron now, joining us from Peshtigo. Aaron, hi.
Hey, good morning, Kate. So I'm a farmer in Peshtigo. I don't dairy. I raise beef cattle and pigs, but dairy is big around my area. And it seems like every week there's another farm going up for auction, and it's having a terrible impact on my rural community. I've known farmers that have committed suicide because of their despair over the loss of their business. It's really having a terrible impact. And it's a lot of farms have off-farm income. Farmers are working two jobs. They're milking cows every morning and night and going to town for a farm job during the day. And we don't expect anybody else to subsidize the cost of food for the rest of the nation, but we do expect farmers to be able to take this low pay and so that the customers can have a low price at the grocery store. You know, if we just paid a few more cents per gallon of milk, the farmer could actually have a decent living wage, and we could have thriving rural communities again.
Aaron, have you been to any of these auctions in your community?
Unfortunately, yes.
What is it like?
It's pretty disappointing. Nobody's happy about watching their neighbor's cows get sold. And nobody feels real good about buying them either. But the state of the situation we're in.
Aaron, thank you for that perspective. Bobbi, what do you hear there?
Well, first of all, Aaron, I appreciate your acknowledgement of the situation from somebody who's a farmer but not directly in dairy. So we do recognize that this is not just a problem that's affecting dairy farmers. This is affecting neighbors and entire communities. When farmers are going out of business, they are the economic engine for these rural communities. So all of that economic activity leaves with them. So I definitely relate to Aaron's comments, and what he's saying is what we're seeing across the country in these rural communities where we're having dairy farm exits.
Let's go to Rachel now, joining us from Fort Atkinson. Rachel, hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello. Hello?
Yes, we're here, Rachel. What is on your mind?
Hi.
Yeah.
I just want to say that we need more antitrust laws so that we can keep the farmers in the communities. I'm currently a high school student, and I've been noticing that our football games and our bring your tractor to school days have been getting quieter and quieter because the farmers are leaving their community. We need these antitrust laws and more focus on mental health for these farmers because they are what keep our community strong and what makes Wisconsin, Wisconsin.
Rachel, do you plan to go into farming?
No, but I am actually a farmers union member.
Do you see in your community that there are fewer farmers and perhaps fewer people your age going in those footsteps?
Yes, I have a friend that lost their family's dairy farm this past year, and less people are being able to support their farms because the cost of production outweigh what they're being paid.
Rachel, thank you for the call. And she's calling for more antitrust laws there.
Yeah, so that's something that we're hearing as a big part of this discussion and something else that Farmers Union has been focusing on over the last year or so. We recognize that the concentration in agriculture is really squeezing farmers because they have fewer options for where to buy the necessary inputs that they need to run their farms. And meanwhile, the prices that they're getting back are getting lower and lower. So this is an important piece of this puzzle that we do need to have stronger antitrust laws. We need to restore competition in the marketplace, and that will go a long way for rural communities.
These Dairy Together meetings are open to the public, but you've also invited lawmakers and their staffs. How have they taken the policy suggestions that are being brought up across the country?
We really appreciate that we've had strong attendance from elected officials' offices at all of our meetings because they're coming because they want to know what we're talking about, but they also want to see what people's reactions are to these ideas. So it's powerful for them to be in a room that's packed full of dairy farmers and people who are interested in these ideas, asking questions, and for them to see that there's real support and a real need and a sense of urgency for doing something about this dairy price crisis. So that's what they need to hear in order to take action at the federal level. They need to see this groundswell of support coming up from rural communities. And I think that these Dairy Together Roadshow meetings are demonstrating that.
And you really feel that it's federal legislation that is going to change the course here and actually address this crisis?
Yeah, it has to be federal policy because for supply management to work, it needs to be national and it needs to be mandatory. It needs to apply across the board to everyone. And when I say that, as an example, if Wisconsin alone were to adopt a supply management program and restrict our growth just in this state, that's not going to stop farmers in California or Texas or elsewhere from ramping up production to take advantage of this new market access. So that's what I mean by it needs to be national and mandatory, and to do that, we need federal policy.
So outside of supply management on a federal level, policy level, is there anything that we can do in our own smaller communities to help change the course here about this dairy crisis?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the best thing that people can do is to be aware of this issue and to come to these meetings. Folks like Aaron, who just called in, who's not a dairy farmer, but is really in tune with the issues and knows how he's personally being affected. All of these people really do have a stake in the dairy economy. So please come to the meetings, visit dairytogether.com and find out other ways that you can get involved by signing petitions, getting in touch with your elected officials. There are a number of things that people can do outside of dairy to support this movement.
Bobby, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Bobby Wilson is Government Relations Associate for the Wisconsin Farmers Union, and more information about the Dairy Together Roadshow events can be found at dairytogether.com. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.